Well, we come now this morning to our biographical address, and the topic of this address is Heinrich Bullinger. Heinrich Bullinger, or to use his English name, Henry Bullinger, born in 1504, belonged to the early Reformation period, so at the very early stages of the work of God's Spirit, Reformation that was taking place in Europe. And I think we need to be clear in our minds that what was taking place at the time of the Reformation was by no means parochial. There was an international movement that was taking place that was intricately interwoven and connected. So what was happening in all of these places in Eastern Europe and in Switzerland and Germany and in France and in the British Isles and beyond, it was one giant work. And there was cross-pollination that was constantly taking place. These men were in close connection and in persistent dialogue with one another. And so there's this interconnectedness. In fact, there's an interconnectedness between the Reformation and what went before it. The Reformation didn't just say, voila, here's something brand new. They were drawing on the toolbox that had been bequeathed to them and things that had been done before. Of course, they disposed of what wasn't biblical, but they kept a great deal that was biblical. So there's a connectedness historically, but there's also this connectedness in terms of geography, in terms of the world as a whole. And I think Bullinger especially highlights this. You'll hear in this very brief and abbreviated address an example of how this was fleshed out, of the connections between the godly people living in various places in Europe. And I think Bullinger is important for us because, among other things, he's an unsung hero of the Reformation. Now, there's been a lot more academic attention that's been given to him in recent years over the last decade or two, but generally, for those in the pew, he's still relatively unknown to us English-speaking Americans, and that is our loss, our significant loss, because this man had a tremendous influence in his own day and in subsequent periods of history. In fact, I'm going to say, and this is not hyperbole, he is one of the most influential leaders at the time of the early Reformation. One of the most influential leaders. In fact, he was far, far, far more influential than John Calvin was. And in the early stages of the Reformation, and really the secondary stages of the Reformation, Bullinger carried far more weight than Calvin did. Calvin, of course, comes a little bit later on the heels of Bullinger, but Calvin didn't until the next century really begin to get the kind of widespread influence that has endured to the present day. People think of themselves as Calvinists, and he's a familiar name. Well, Bullinger had that place first, and I think it's to our peril that we know so little about him at this time. One person has dubbed him the architect of the Reformation, speaking of the Reformed wing of the Reformation over against the Lutheran. So let's look just briefly at some of the things with regards to his life. As I've already alluded to, he hailed from the country of Switzerland, so he's a native Swiss, born and bred, spent his whole life in Switzerland. Some of you will know a little bit about Switzerland, perhaps, but Switzerland as a country was actually comprised of a confederation of cantons. So a canton was like a state, if you will, and they were a confederation that had kind of joined, leagued together as these independent cantons. And so, for example, each canton had its own money and its own constitution and its own army. And yet they leagued together at various points in their political enterprises. Bullinger was a part of what we call German-speaking Switzerland, right? He spoke Swiss German. So if you're thinking in your head of there's Switzerland, the West end of Switzerland is French-speaking, so we think of John Calvin in Geneva, or you think of Viret or Farel. I mean, these guys were all French-speaking Swiss. Calvin's, of course, a Frenchman who lived in Switzerland. But then the bulk of the rest of Switzerland actually spoke and still speaks Swiss German. So he's a German-speaking Swiss. He was born on July 18th, 1504, in the medieval town of Bremgarten, which is just west of Zurich, one of the major cities in Switzerland, kind of north-central Switzerland, if you will. He was the youngest of five sons. There were also two daughters, so seven children as a whole. And interestingly, he was actually born to a parish priest. Now, children, for most of you, you should be thinking to yourself, oh, that sounds a little funny, doesn't it? Because priests, Roman Catholic priests, were required to take a vow of celibacy. They weren't allowed to be married, and they weren't allowed to have children. And yet, he's born to this parish priest, and there's speculation about whether he paid off the town council to let him live in this kind of common law marriage, or what the situation was. But, in fact, his father wasn't married until Henry was 25 years old. So his father had actually been married for nearly 40 years when he was actually officially married in a Reformed church at a Reformed wedding, and so on. There are a number of remarkable deliverances in Henry's life as a child. You can see the hand of Providence in his early days. God had created him to do great work for Christ's kingdom. And that meant from his conception onward, the Lord's hand was watching over him. And so, as a little child, the Lord was preparing him for future usefulness. Let me just give you three brief accounts about the Lord's deliverance. We don't know many details. But first of all, he contracted the plague. You'll remember the plague from especially the 14th century on continues to ravage and resurface throughout Europe all the way up into the Puritan era, you know, 1660s, and so on in places like Britain and elsewhere. So you'll, in the account that you read of Calvin, he's having to duck and flee the plague as many of his colleagues are, and so on. Well, as a child, he contracted the plague and barely, by a hair's breadth, recovered. But he was spared. He didn't die. On another occasion, as a little boy, like many of you little boys, he was running through the street and he tripped. He fell. He was carrying a whistle and the whistle was plunged into his neck. Well, once again, the Lord kept him and he was preserved there. On another occasion, he narrowly escaped being abducted. So children, he came this close to being kidnapped as a child and was delivered from that as well. Well, he reached the age of five and he was sent to Latin school in Bremgarten. Normally you had to be seven to begin school, but he began Latin school at age five, and from age five to 12, this was his education. When he went to school, from the time he arrived to the time he went home, he was never allowed to speak a syllable of German. Everything was spoken and written and conducted in the Latin tongue over the course of those years. Then he went on to Emmerich with his older brother, a city on the Rhine, to continue his education. When he was sent off, his father restricted his income. So here's this, you know, 12-year-old being sent off with his older brother, and he says, well, I'm sending you really pocket change. And his father did that in order to teach Henry moderation. Well, two things. In order to teach him moderation, to live frugally, and secondly, to inculcate within him sympathy for the poor. And so here is Henry in this city on the Rhine, far from home, and he literally has to go door to door begging. And what he would do is he would sing for money. So he had learned to sing in the school that he was in previously. He would go door to door and say, can I sing for you in exchange for pay? And that's how he gathered the resources, the meager resources that he had in order to sustain himself throughout that stretch of his education. This didn't seem to bother Henry. In fact, he was inclined early on to join the Carthusians, which was the strictest order of the monks. And so he seemed to have come under this quite willingly. In 1519, he went off to the University of Cologne and got both his bachelor's degree and his master's degree there. It was while he was at Cologne that he engaged in reading Lombard and common medieval systematic theology text. He was reading the patristics like Chrysostom and Athanasius and Augustine and others. But what was especially notable is that he was there introduced to the early writings of Martin Luther. And so he began to read these in the time that was given to him. In 1522, there was a burning, as many of these sorts of things, by the Roman Church. There was a burning of Luther's books, and a public burning, and this prompted him to really hammer down and to devote himself to the study of theology, to figure out what is going on here and what exactly is the truth. And it was in that season that he was actually brought into evangelical views, where he came to see and understand justification by faith and the gospel, and closed with Christ and was brought to the Lord. At that point, he goes back to his father in Bremgarten, and January 1523, he becomes the head teacher of the monastery at Kappel. So while he's with his father, he continues his studies. His father apparently was supportive of it, so his father gave him full rein, and he studied all of the early works of Luther and was reading his New Testament and was studying all these things with his father's blessing. He gained some reputation, which brought about the invitation to become the head teacher of the monastery at Kappel. And interestingly, he went there under the condition that he would not have to take the monastic vows. So he said, I'll become head teacher, but I will not attend the Mass, I will not take any of the monastic vows, and I have to be allowed to teach the things that I find in the Bible. And remarkably, for whatever reason, they agreed to this. And so he was able to go to the monastery without those points of compromise. So he went and engaged in lecturing on the scriptures themselves. He actually wrote Latin commentaries on most of the New Testament. And through his teaching, in 1525, the Mass was actually abolished from the monastery, and the monastery became reformed in their persuasions and a bastion of gospel light. It was during this period that he met what ended up being his chief influence and mentor, Zwingli. So most of us, if you know anything about Reformation history, you know about the Swiss Reformation, you always associate Zwingli and Bullinger together, right? Bullinger is the disciple, the successor of Zwingli. This is where they first meet. He ends up going and attending the first disputation with the Anabaptist, and then the second two, he ends up being clerk for the disputations between Zwingli and the Anabaptists. So a disputation, I could do a whole lecture on this. It would be very interesting for me anyway. They had these, there was a very formal structure drawing on kind of a medieval toolbox, which put a high premium on logic and careful distinctions and scholastic method and order and so on. And they would have a topic that was going to be debated, and it was incredibly thorough. They would go through and explain, this is what the issue is, these are all the things the issue is not, here are the strongest arguments, and then here are 50 reasons that refute those. Here's what the truth is, and here are all the arguments for that. Here's the testimony of Scripture, here's the testimony of the Church Fathers. You know, it's this very elaborate process that they would go through. So he's engaged with Zwingli. He's kind of tagging along with him in these disputations with the Anabaptists. In 1527, he went on to attend Zwingli's lectures in Zurich. So Zwingli is associated with the great city of Zurich. It's a huge, significant city at the time, remains so to today. There he learned mastered his Greek and Hebrew. In 1529, he ends up leaving the monastery and succeeding his father, who's become reformed and embraced the gospel, as the pastor of his hometown in Bremgarten. And under his influence, the town becomes a thoroughly reformed city or town, and proves to be a bastion of light during that season. When he accepted the invitation as pastor there, his first sermon to the congregation was on worshiping God in spirit and in truth. He put the worship of God at the very front and center in the heartthrob of his message to the city and to his congregation. Well, that spread with great influence, and as did the rest of his ongoing ministry there. It was in August of that same year that he married an ex-nun named Anna, whom he was married to for the remainder of his years. Interesting, just a few little anecdotes with regards to this. There were two nuns that had withdrawn from the nunnery and embraced the gospel. The fact is, Henry knew almost nothing about Anna. He knew very little about her. He had heard about her reputation. He knew about her love for the gospel, and there were things that he knew. But he writes her this letter and basically says, marry me. And 2 weeks later, she writes back and says, okay, I'm gonna marry you. And it's interesting because her mother, whom she lived with, required a few things. One was that she had to marry a rich man. Well, Henry was poor, poor as dirt, right? He was not a man of noble birth or had come from great riches or anything else. So, but anyway, she agrees to marry him, and they're actually engaged within 2 weeks' time. But then it's extended 2 years. She wanted to honor her mother, and so she said, we'll have to wait until my mother dies. And eventually, 2 years later, the mother dies, and they just get married almost immediately after that. If you want to understand the character of the woman, and we know very little about her, there's at one point, she's in Bremgarten, and he's in Zurich, and he's been restricted. He's not allowed to leave. In fact, I don't think it was while he was in Zurich, but he's restricted to a city. They've locked down the place. She's not allowed to leave the town to go to her husband. And so, with stealth, she tries to sneak out of the city with two babies. So she's got these two babies, and she tries to sneak out of the city to go to be with her husband. And she's actually stopped by the city guards. And this woman overpowers an armed man, wrests the keys from him, unlocks the door to the gates, slips out of the city, and then walks through the middle of the night 10 miles with two babies in order to be reconciled to her husband. So you get a sense that this woman had chutzpah, right? She had some character and strength herself. And what we know of her, she was an exceedingly pious woman. In 1631, Zwingli is killed in battle. Zwingli is 57. And this is during the Capel War, and this is a story in its own right, but it should be kept for Zwingli's own biographical address. There's a very touching account of the last meeting between the mentor and the mentoree, the disciple, and they spend time together before he goes off to war. There's all sorts of controversy about whether the war should have happened, about Zwingli's role. Zwingli was a warrior through and through, man. This guy's heart just throbbed with zeal for the glory of God, and he was a warrior both spiritually and physically. And so there's this touching account of Zwingli giving his blessing to Bullinger and speaking words of consolation together. Off he goes, dons on his armor, and rides out to lead his section of the army into battle. And he's killed in that battle. His helmet is cleaved, and the Roman Catholics capture him. He's drawn, he's quartered, and his body is burned to ashes, typical Roman Catholic style. Well, as a result, Bullinger ends up succeeding Zwingli at the church at Zurich. So they look to him and say, you're the man. We want you to take this very important post. So you got this city that has great influence and significance throughout the Swiss cantons, and he is given the responsibility for leading them. Many who heard his ministry at that point, in fact, I think it was Myconius who says that the people spread throughout the city and said, Zwingli is raised from the dead. You know, when they heard the ministry of Bullinger and heard his preaching and so on. Both Henry and Anna had, they had 11 children. They had six sons and five daughters. We're told that all five sons actually went into the gospel ministry. They all became ministers. In addition to that, they adopted, both kind of formally and informally, a number of others. One of them, in 1532, Rudolf Gwalther, which some of you may know if you've read, he actually came to their home at 13, and he was raised basically as a son in their home, kind of informally adopted, as if you will. He eventually, not formally adopted, he became Bullinger's son-in-law, marrying one of his daughters eventually, and then he's the one, Walter Gwalther, who actually succeeded Henry at his death in 1575. The ministry of Henry during his period in Zurich is really the thing that he's known best for. There was much when he got there that hung in the balance. The wars that Zwingli died in give you a little indicator of what was going on. It's as if Zurich and other parts of Switzerland were hung in the balance. Are they going to be swept back under the Roman See, or are they going to be enduring for a Reformed witness? And there's all sorts of breathless anticipation about what's going to happen. Through the Lord's blessing on Henry's ministry, the work of the Reformation was consolidated in Zurich, and he had a role, a very strong role, with the city council and the legislations that were implemented. He had a role in reorganizing the synod in 1532, the Swiss synod as well, and he preached constantly. He preached to the council, so he would go and he would address very forthrightly the civil magistrates, and he would contradict them where they were differing with the testimony of the church, bringing them into persuasive alignment with the church. I'll say more about this in a second. His understanding of the relationship of church and state was different than Calvin's, and very different than our own. So it's very different than the Scottish wing of the Reformation. And we'll see some of that influence on, for example, England in a minute. As I said, he was preaching constantly. I mean, this is not uncommon. I've told you about Calvin's preaching every day in Geneva. It was the same with Bullinger. He's preaching every day. In fact, preaching twice a day sometimes throughout the week. Tireless in his labor. In addition to that, his publications were voluminous. I mean, he's producing, for example, his correspondence. We have 12,000 extant letters. Now you say, okay, let me put that in perspective. If you take all of Luther's letters, and if you take all of Zwingli's letters, and if you take all of Calvin's letters and combine them, you have 9,500 letters. Bullinger, we have 12,000 just from him. I mean, remember what I said at the beginning about the interconnectedness. He's writing people in Poland and Hungary and in what we think of as the Czech Republic, people in Eastern Europe. He's writing, you know, the folk in the Netherlands and in Germany and in France and in England and Scotland. I mean, this tremendous work that he's carrying forward. And there were much more that was going on as well. His house had revolving doors on it, right? Refugees from all over Europe were coming and staying with them, exiles coming and living with them. In fact, there's a list, and it is a mile long, a list of the who's who. Now, it wouldn't be names that are familiar to you, perhaps, but a list of the who's who actually lived for a period in Bullinger's house, just revolving doors. He was very, 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 one of the most dominant roles in trying to work for the reconciliation between Zurich and the Lutherans. And he had a temperament different from Zwingli that was forbearing and patient and willing to endure and trying very hard to secure unity on sound grounds, not at the expense of truth. These were pursuits that actually didn't materialize because he had to, in the end of the day, hold to the truth in departing from the Lutherans. But there was this work that he's carrying on. In 1537, he's now serving not only as pastor, but also professor of theology. The year before, he assisted in producing the first Helvetic Confession. So one of the early significant Reformed confessions that were produced. We find his connection with England, and if we're to draw lines between Bullinger and Switzerland and anywhere else, the primary line is the connection with England. So he has influence everywhere, but especially in England. He's John Hooper, for example. Some of you will remember him. Again, I'm assuming you've read some of your Reformed history. Hooper's the one who was very involved in the vestment controversy and some of the other battles that were taking place over high church issues and worship in England. He lived, Hooper and his wife lived with Henry Bullinger and his wife from 1547 to 1549. But even more importantly, Henry was the author of the Second Helvetic Confession. Now, you hear the word Helvetic. Let me make sure you're not missing things here. Helvetica is the Latin word for Switzerland. Okay, so you hear Second Helvetic Confession. It's really Second Swiss Confession, if you will. This is 1566. He is the author of the Second Helvetic Confession. And folks, if you don't know this, you should. It is one of the most important, one of the most significant Reformed confessions in the history of the world. So it received more widespread international reception and acceptance than any other confession. So it was adopted by people in Eastern Europe, Poland and Hungary, for example. It was adopted by folk in France and in Germany, of course in Switzerland. It was adopted by those in the Netherlands and in England, right? Countries are taking this confession and saying, we are formally adopting it as the confession of our faith. One thing you won't know about your history is that in our church, Scotland was actually the first one to adopt it outside of Switzerland. Before all these other countries, Scotland formally adopted the Second Helvetic Confession in 1566. And it served for a time until Scotland produced its own confession. So huge influence, as I said, especially in England. Bullinger was primarily a preacher. So he was he had theological acumen. He was a theologian of repute, but he was especially a powerful and persistent preacher of the Reformed doctrine. So we can't say that Bullinger didn't make the kind of contributions theologically that you would see, for example, from Calvin, right? He's not in the same league when it comes to those sorts of contributions to our understanding of the Reformed doctrines. He did make contributions, and I'll highlight one or two here, but he was especially gifted at the propagation of those doctrines, of explaining them, breaking them down, applying them, expounding them, sending them forth to the masses. And the thing that he's most known for in terms of his books are his Decades. I'll mention them again more in a moment. Still in print. Dr. Peakey has them in print in two volumes. If you don't have them, it'd be worth your money to buy them. They're called Decades. They're basically, the book is divided up into five decades. So five sets of 10 sermons. So a decade is a book of 10 sermons. And so there are these 50 sermons where he's preaching basically through the whole system of Reformed theology. I mean, this was reprinted even in English, you know, like 1 year, 77 times, you know, by a different date, had been reprinted 137 times, the English versions of Latin and English versions of the Decades. Very influential. In terms of his theology, let me make a few comments. He obviously was influenced by Luther early on, embraced justification by faith. He's helped by Luther, but he departs from Luther pretty early on. So, for example, law and gospel. Luther had a very distinct view on law and gospel, which is entirely different from the Reformed view of the relationship of the law and the gospel. And from the early days, right, we see this in Bullinger. He departs from Luther and sees an interconnected relationship between the law and the gospel that is really missed in the kind of dichotomy that dominates, at least, Luther's understanding. There's questions, you know, Calvin and Zwingli were both very strong on double predestination, both superlapsarian. You know, Bullinger's been criticized. Is he weak on, you know, predestination? It's been proven, and I think irrefutably, that he was not weak. I mean, it wasn't the thing that he spent as much time on as others, but both the Second Helvetic and the Decades teach double predestination, that God both decreed the election of his people and the reprobation of the damned. He also had a role, of course, in all of the debates over the Lord's Supper, right? So there's Luther has his view, Rome has their view, Luther has his view, Zwingli has his view, Calvin has his view. So there's a lot of turmoil over the nature of Christ's presence at the Lord's Supper. And at the colloquy of Marburg, which was in 1529, very important meeting, and I would have to digress too far to kind of break that open for you, but it's an interesting story, right? It's the place where you hear the account of Luther is there, Zwingli's there. Luther is pounding on the table. You can see the table bouncing with Luther pounding with his fist. This is my body in Latin. This is my body. Demanding the physical presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper. Well, Bullinger had a different view. Like Calvin, of course, had a different view. Zwingli had a different view. And when it says, this is my body, they understood that to mean it represents Christ's physical body, that his physical body is in heaven and not physically in the supper itself. Bullinger standing against Luther on that. He is very significant in terms of the development of covenant theology. So Zwingli, his successor, was a very important player in the development of covenant theology before Calvin and many of the other guys that were at work in the Reformation. So, for example, Zwingli was the first person to use covenant theology as the argument for infant baptism. So when he's debating the catabaptists, right, what we think of as Baptists, credo baptism, Zwingli was the first to employ the argument of the continuity of the covenant as one of the arguments for the necessity of infant baptism, seeing this unity of Old and New Testament. Bullinger picked that up, embraced it himself, but then he also brought some nuance. You know, Zwingli would especially be emphasizing the promise. Bullinger comes along and says, well, if we're going to be faithful to the biblical text and our exegesis, absolutely the promise is the big thing, the main thing, but we also have to recognize that there are requirements in the covenant, right? So we have the promises of the covenant. There are also conditions in the covenant. Faith is required of those that are baptized and brought up in the covenant community. They're required to close with Christ in the gospel, and he works that out. Now, he, of course, acknowledges that Christ is the one who purchased our faith. The Spirit is the one who gives the gift of faith, so that only his elect are able to respond with faith to the promises. But he develops what ends up becoming the dominant position within the Reformed churches throughout the next two centuries. He's also clear on the fact that faith is not, or that assurance is not of the essence of faith. And he has a lot to say about the relationship of faith and assurance. I mentioned earlier his views on the relationship of church and state. Here he departs, I think, from the truth. He believed that the magistrate was actually over the church. So basically, you draw the geographical boundaries. Here's our country. Well, the magistrate's responsible for everything in the country. Well, the church is in the country. So the magistrate's responsible for the church as well. And he's actually using his covenant theology at this point, though he makes some missteps, obviously. And he's taking an Old Testament model and not making the kind of clear distinctions that someone like George Gillespie later on would make in his Aaron's Rod Blossoming and so on. He conflates them, whereas later on we come to realize, well, even in the Old Testament, there are very distinct jurisdictions, that the state had its own offices, and it had its own, had the sword, and its own civil responsibilities, and the church had its own officers, and its ordinances and responsibilities as well. They were obviously mutual supportive, but they were distinct. That was not as clear in the writings of Bullinger. So he believes that the magistrate has a responsibility for establishing religion in the country. Fair enough, we would believe with that. But he also says they have the responsibility for the discipline. So he's given the keys of the kingdom to the magistrate, and he's wrong when he does that. He ends up, some of this comes out because he's battling the Anabaptists, right? You have the radicals of the Reformation, And in refuting their error, I think he's pushed in this direction and ends up not striking the balance that we find in Scripture. But if you're following me here, you begin to see, the connection with England, right? Because England ends up becoming Erastian. They hold to the fact that the church, that the state is over the church, right? The Queen, to this present day, is the head of the church in England. And there's cross-pollination going on, right? At a number of levels, not just this one, between Bullinger and those that are in England. So all of that is interesting. Calvin, of course, says Bullinger's wrong on these points, and England's wrong, and takes a view that's closer to what was adopted in Scotland. With regards to the Lord's Supper, Bullinger actually is closely related to Zwingli's view, but he does differ with him. But Bullinger ultimately says that in the Supper we have a testimony of God's grace, whereas in Calvin he's saying, no, we have an instrument of God's grace. And there's a difference. At the Consensus Tigurinus, there's this council that's held trying to get unity, and that's again another story. But Bullinger is working with Calvin to try to find a middle balance. And they make some progress, though both of them give up things they would rather not have given up. Let me skip a few things here to speed up. I think another mark of Bullinger's ministry, and you see this perhaps because of his pastor's heart, Zwingli is a warrior. He's very theologically robust. He's strong. He wasn't devoid of the pastoral heart and tendencies and so on, but it wasn't as dominant as you get in Bullinger. And Bullinger, consequently, really cultivates and emphasizes what we've subsequently come to call experimental religion. So he's teaching these doctrines, but he's doing so in a way that really reflects kind of what we associate with the Puritans, you know, in the century that follows. He's also, of course, a man of peace. He was very influential as an international educator. He encouraged the Reformed leaders to encourage their people to adopt all of these orphans. There's just countless orphans. As a result of the wars, as a result of the plague, you have all of these children. He's saying, gather them in. Let's bring them into the covenant, raise them up in the truth of God's word. He had students that came from near and far and sent them off into other parts of Europe. And therefore, through his educational work, had a far-reaching impact. I've mentioned earlier that he was very productive in his publishing. I'll mention more about that in just a second. We come to the end of his life, and the Black Death is rolling through. He ends up contracting the plague, 1564 to 65. It looks as if he's going to die. He ends up recovering once again, but he's never quite the same. So he has severe, in his old age, severe or acute kidney trouble. His wife actually dies from the plague. He recovers, she doesn't, and she dies. All of his friends gather around, and they're all this pressure. You need to remarry right away, and remarry, and so on and so forth. And he refused. So he was stubborn. And he said, there cannot be, and there will not be, any second Anna. And so he never did remarry. He died as a widower. That same year, several of their children died. So Mama's laid in the grave. Right after, same time, some of his children are dying from the plague. He's born, of course, 5 years before Calvin, and gets a head start in terms of reformed things. But then he lives a whole decade after Calvin. Right, he actually outlives Calvin by 10 years. And at the end, his friends come to him and they tell him, we're praying for your recovery and so on. And I didn't print out the quotation about his words, but you see in him a holy submission. I mean, he's at the end of his days. He's had a horrifically difficult life, many, many sorrows, many battles, many difficulties. And he, in essence, says, if the Lord still has work for me to do, I will submit. I will live on and continue to serve my master. But I would love if he would take me home. You know, if the Lord is ready to bring me to behold the glory of Christ and to go into the presence of the one whom I love, then that's what I would wish. But there's this submission. He's not saying, God must take me home. And he's not saying, must I live? There's this holiness. And so he dies at age 71, which in that period of time was a very ripe old age. Just a couple of comments before we close here. I've noted his influence as a leader. For example, Ursinus and Olivianus, the two authors of the Heidelberg Catechism, were his students. They studied under Bullinger. And in fact, they wrote and said that Bullinger's influence on them, not only the decades, but some of his other writings, had a huge impact on the Heidelberg Catechism, on the way in which they penned the Heidelberg Catechism. He was tireless in his labors. He preached through 53 books of scripture. He wrote 13 commentaries. He published over 600 sermons. And then I've told you about his copious correspondence as well. The Decades, the book that you still have in print for a decent price in English, was by far the most influential and was read, translated into all sorts of languages, ones you would expect and not expect, and spread throughout the world, had the kind of influence that Calvin's Institutes had. But they're a different flavor. I mean, they're sermons, right? He's covering the gamut, if you will, of Reformed theology, but it's within the context of preaching. So it has that flavor. And I think that's one of the reasons it's been so loved and valued and used throughout the centuries. It's almost as if the Institutes and the Decades are complementary, right? Calvin is very precise, very careful, very organized, very systematic in his exposition of the doctrine. And that's helpful. And then you have kind of the heartthrob, the life of this Reformed preaching in Bullinger. And they serve one another well. His preaching was theological, and Calvin's theology was practical, was aiming at godliness. If you have any exposure to the Institutes, you'll note that, in contrast to maybe some of the systematic theologies produce sense. One thing I think we can take away from this is just the way in which our Reformed fathers viewed time. So I've made this comment many times now. One of the blind spots of our generation is our concept of time. The amount of time that we devote to leisure, the amount of time that we devote to recreation, the amount of time that we devote to play is disproportionate to anything you will find in the ancient church, in the Reformation church, and really since. We have been swept up with our American culture. It's not as if, well, we're being deliberate and biblical in our views. No, we're kind of being swept along with the society around us. And quite frankly, the society around us looks a whole lot like the disintegrating Roman Empire, far more than the church that we see in the New Testament scriptures. These people viewed time as a precious commodity, and they were tireless in their labors. He lived to be 71. You can't say, well, he killed himself working too hard, died at 30. But they were tireless. I mean, what would it take? The hospitality, the preaching every day, the correspondence, the books that are being written, all of the work with the civil magistrate, all of the work with the synod and these ecumenical meetings that are happening and so on and so forth. It's staggering. How is it possible to squeeze this into a life that's this short? Well, one of the reasons is they believed they were created for the glory of God and not their own self-seeking pleasure. They were not created to be happy. They were not created to gratify themselves. They were not created and given all the gifts that God had given them to make themselves fat and happy. They realized we have stewardship. We have responsibility. And the gifts and graces God's given, the time He's given to us, it needs to be harnessed. And it needs to be employed for what will bring glory to our King. and not just gratification to our own lusts and flesh. There's something to be learned here. And there are many who want to sit and put their glasses at the end of their nose and say, these guys were over the top, doing too much. And I'm afraid, and I'll say it, the reason that that's the case is because we are so far off the charts in our imbalance in the other direction that it looks radical to us. We're the ones who need to be put to the test. We're the ones who need to say, we have something to learn, rather than condescending and teaching those who have gone before us and done so much for the kingdom. Another mark in his life that I think should be cultivated is a small c Catholicity. Bullinger was not parochial. Now, he was a Swiss, and he, you know, was giving himself to the work of the Reformation in Switzerland. But he had an international, worldwide heart for the church. He sacrificed in order to care for the people in Eastern Europe and to aid the people in England. And he was willing to sit down and say, you know, to the Lutherans, let's try our level best to work through the issues without compromising truth, to be able to come together as brethren. And he wanted a biblical, principial connection and unity with the church. And he didn't just say, I'm taking my basketball and going home. If you don't agree with me, I dismiss you. I'm out of here. No, he labored and said, I'm going to listen. My ears are wide open. I want to represent what you're saying accurately. I want to understand what you're saying. And then here's what we see as a problem. Here's what the Swiss churches find objectionable to your views. And so he's laboring for a small c Catholicity rather than a ghetto mentality. And we need to be aware of that. It's not us and them. And we're in our own little cluster where us against the world kind of thing. We do need to be able to say, we're going to stand for Christ's glory. We're going to stand for the truth. Let the blood run. We will die defending it. And have all of that spirit with a desire to win others. To be taught ourselves, to be humble, and to win others to the truth. To build bridges with others. Another thing I think, and it goes very much with what I've just said, is the burden that he had for church and state. So he carried on his heart what we sing in Psalm 137. He was given his lifeblood for the cause of Zion. He had longed his whole life for the good of the church and of the people of God. And he's saying the church is absolutely essential. It is the kingdom of Christ. And he gave his lifeblood to serve Christ's bride and to build up the walls of Zion. And it wasn't without an eye to the state either. I mean, he lived in a different day than we did. He had a microphone that went straight into the ears of the magistrate, and they listened to him. But he was interested to see, we want a reformed nation. We want the whole country organized after the Bible. So in the civil sphere, you need to own the true religion, and you need to promote the glory of God within that context. So there was a burden for these things. But then lastly, and I'll close with this, there was a burden as well for vibrant godliness. If you read Calvin, if you read Zwingli, you know, you read Oakley and Pottius or Capito, it doesn't matter, any of these early guys, you know, Bucer as well, they all talk about the connection between sound theology and practical piety. And they had a view. Calvin is explicit in the preface to his Institutes, I am interested in godliness being propagated, and that will only happen with sound theology. And so it's not as if when you get to the Second Reformation, the Nader-Reformatie in the Netherlands, or the Puritans in England, or the Covenanters in Scotland, that this is some new idea. Right? They're just carrying on what had been a burden from the beginning. A vibrant, exercised godliness that would characterize the people, looking like Christ, and thus bringing glory to the Lord Jesus Christ. And it worked its way out into every compartment of their lives and of their society, because they desired the King, the glory that belongs to the King. And what you'll find, of course, in every one of these biographical addresses is the same theme song. And that is, they were consumed with a passion for the glory of Christ. Bullinger didn't look to to make a name for himself. He didn't want to be, he didn't want, 300 years later to be called, Bullingerists rather than Calvinists. Calvin didn't want that either. He was interested in the propagation of the glory of Christ himself. Calvin, as some of you know, forbade that his grave would even be marked. He was buried in an unmarked grave. That gives you a window into Calvin's heart and mentality. He was not looking for his name to be preserved. He gave his strength, as did Henry Bullinger, for the propagation of the glory of Christ. When you think to yourself as a Christian, what do I want to come out of my life? What do I want to come out of my family? What do I want to come out of our congregation? Or whatever else. It better not be, I want to create a great legacy for our family. I want to create, something that will endure, that I'll be remembered for. I want to create, this, that, or the other thing. That, my friends, that is perilous, right? We can make idols out of anything, and the Lord smashes idols. Our goal is to see the glory of Christ propagated. And if we do things that contribute to that, we will have reached our heart's desire, though we are not remembered 3 days after we're laid in the dust. Well, may the Lord